Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. The Umbrella Hour is brought to you by the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Lots of opportunities at this institute for those who are interested in sex therapy and want to gain a deeper understanding about sexual intimacy and health. There are online live classes via webinar, students from multiple countries participating in the same cohort, flexible scheduling options, open enrollment all year long with multiple class track options. And it's open to professionals already, either working in therapy, medicine, education, or social services, pursuing their doctoral level training without leaving their careers. Your hosts today are Dr. Ahn, board-certified clinical sexologist, and Xander Keg, licensed clinical social worker. I'm going to now turn this over to Xander, who will, as usual, introduce our guests.
Hello, everybody. Yes, thank you, Ahn. Really great to be here with everybody, and I'm looking forward to this conversation. So let me just get started. Our guest today is Betsy Kalin. Betsy is an award-winning filmmaker. She's the founder of Itchy Bee Productions. She's the creator of the film Lesbians in Boys Town and the winner of the Best Documentary and Audience Award at the HQSFF. And we'll have to ask what that stands for. But welcome to the show, Betsy.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
What's HQSFF?
It is the Hollywood Queer Short Film Festival.
Very cool. Well, congratulations on winning the Best Documentary and Audience Award. Let's go back in time a little bit, and you can tell us what got you started in filmmaking. You're also a professor of film at a university, so maybe we can just talk about what got you interested in filmmaking and then into the industry of filmmaking and then the work that you're doing now, and then we'll go from there.
Sure. I was really lucky that my high school had photography. And so I started working in high school in photography, taking photographs, doing black and white developing, and I really loved it. But I wanted to tell bigger stories, right, than I could with just a photograph. And so I got into, at the time, video. And then when I was in college, I was at Columbia University, and they have a wonderful graduate film program, and they actually let us undergrads take grad classes there. And so I audited a bunch of classes and just found my love of cinema in all forms. And after graduating, I moved to San Francisco and worked for documentary filmmakers in the Bay Area. There's a really strong documentary community there. And I realized that documentary was great for me because it combined storytelling with activism and social change. And I thought that approach really worked for the kind of stories that I wanted to tell. I wanted to tell LGBTQ stories. I wanted to tell stories about forgotten history. I wanted to tell stories about immigrant communities. All of these issues I thought could really be helped by having a documentary and then an impact campaign and strategy around the film.
Very cool. I'm just curious if you have a favorite type of genre of film.
I don't think I consider this a genre, but I like indie film. Whatever falls under independent cinema. I'm a professor of film, and one of my favorite classes to teach besides documentary is independent cinema. I love it. You can look back, especially American independent cinema, but really for myself and viewing, I like anything with subtitles. So anything from anywhere in the world.
I loved your LA interchange. I thought that was superb.
Thank you very much. It only took 10 years, so...
I don't feel bad. I don't feel bad. Thank you. I'm glad that I'm not an anomaly. Yeah. Oh.
No, most documentaries take anywhere from 3 to 10 to more. They're so challenging to make, and it just takes a long time.
What makes them challenging to make?
Well, scripted is scripted. You have actors, you have a script. Documentary is real people and real lives. And in order to tell the story, you need to spend significant time with people. And so that also entails budgets and bigger budgets and more commitments from everyone. And so I think that's part of the thing that makes documentaries very rewarding, because now I have relationships with all these people that have been in my films over many years, which is fantastic. But on the other hand, it costs a lot of money and you have to constantly break and do more fundraising.
I love documentaries, but one of the things that I don't like about them is the non-involvement with the person or the people that are being followed in the documentary. I remember the first time that I had this experience, I saw the movie Southern Comfort, or the documentary Southern Comfort. It was a story about Robert Eads, a trans man who ended up dying due to complications with, I believe it was uterine or cervix cancer. I think it was uterine cancer. And the whole time I was watching it, I was screaming at the screen going, why didn't you take him to a doctor in Atlanta? Why just keep accompanying him to all these local doctors who were refusing to care? Because it was in Georgia and he was living way out in the boonies, very rural area. And somebody said to me, oh, they don't do that. They just follow it. And I was like, oh, I don't like that part of it. Do you find that in some ways there's that tension there?
I mean, that's a big ethical question, and it's really based on the filmmaker. My guess is that they did try to intervene, and they probably asked permission. Would you want something? Would you want me to take you? Would you want? And you leave it up to the person. If the person says, no, I'm happy doing it this way, what can you do? But I think a lot has changed. I mean, I try to be as collaborative as possible with the participants and even teach them things about documentary filmmaking and the process and all of that. But it just depends. I mean, documentary ethics is a really big topic. And I can sense, I mean, I was frustrated watching that film too, but I mean, from watching it, I just had the feeling that maybe they did offer that and it wasn't something that he wanted.
Yeah, that's too bad then, right? Absolutely. So let's talk about your company, Itchy Bee, right? Where does that name come from, Itchy Bee?
It's Itchy Bee Productions. Yeah, it's because all the women in my family have initials that begin with B. And so, I don't know, I just thought bees were cute and I liked bees and I liked itchy. So I just put it together and it's not a production company that anybody else has.
Yeah, I thought, I was like, oh, maybe she has an allergic reaction to bees. And you know, this...
Yes, I do. I do. I do. I have my EpiPen.
So I mentioned in the introduction about lesbians and Boys Town, but maybe you could just give us a rundown of the movies that you've made and maybe what's the story of those other movies? Because it'd be fun to sort of hear about different ones.
Yeah, sure. And Lesbians in Boys Town, which a lot of people think is Chicago, but I'm actually looking at West Hollywood, California in the film. If we had more funding, I would totally go to Chicago, though. I just want to put that out there if anybody's listening. So my other films, I mean, East LA Interchange, we talked about briefly. That is a feature documentary that looks at Boyle Heights in East Los Angeles. And it looks at the history of a diverse, multi-ethnic, multiracial neighborhood from the 1940s to the present and how the people of that neighborhood really had to battle against a lot of outside forces. They built the largest freeway interchange system in North America through the neighborhood. And there were a lot of issues resulting from that around like environmental racism and things like that. And now gentrification. And so the film really looks at the neighbors working together and for a better future. So that's that film. And that was very successful. I'm still being shown just even this year. It was doing like several different screenings. So
how many people were in that film?
I mean, I don't remember exactly, but it had to be over 20 for sure. And maybe more people that I interviewed, because what we did was we had a studio space and we booked people who had lived in the neighborhood to come in 10, 15 minute slots. And which was great because they were all sitting in the waiting room talking to each other and reminiscing and having a great time. And so we would bring them in. And I mean, I think that could have been just 20 people there that we did that day. And then we used those interviews at these little in-between sections of all the different sections in the film. And so the people who came loved it because they got to see their friends. They got to see people they hadn't seen in a long time. And everybody was just enjoying waiting in the waiting room. They didn't even want to come in and talk to us. So,
Betsy, what I loved too was the music because it was so reflective of the different cultures. Xander, have you seen that documentary?
I don't believe I have. No, no. But it's on my list now.
Thank you. Yeah, it's available everywhere. It's on Tubi, Amazon, everywhere. So you can watch it. And yeah, I'm really proud of how well it's still doing. And because it's really, you know, it raises a lot of important issues that are still being discussed today, basically. So even though it came out a little while ago, it's still really relevant.
It is. It's interesting because I was going to ask you about that. Xander, I wish you had seen it, but you'll get the gist of where I'm going with this once you look at it, because I thought about all the change in language. We went from undocumented to using aliens to similar neighborhood raids, and Betsy's film touches on some of that. Yeah, I could see some historical repetitive changes in law and how invasive that was for people.
And still is. I mean, it's one of the neighborhoods that's really impacted by ICE today. So, you know, what's been happening. Yeah. It's hard to see. You have this wonderful picture of a neighborhood where you were helping your neighbor and your neighbors were all from different backgrounds and everybody was really harmonious. And you would hope that that would be something that we would go back to. And it seems that's not what's happening, right?
What I find really interesting is that I grew up in Los Angeles and I know where that community is now, but I never even heard of it growing up. Right. I was in Torrance, Redondo Beach, and a little bit of time in Hawthorne when I was much younger with my father, and never heard of Pearl Heights. I remember things would be referenced as East Los Angeles. So it was an area, not the neighborhoods. I didn't know the names of the neighborhoods. And I think that can be part of something that happens in that when we don't call a place by its name, then it ceases to exist in some ways. Right? It's invisible or it's erased or it's just not given the focus, right? That's a like a cultural thing that can happen that then has an impact directly on the people who live there, because maybe there are really wonderful places in that neighborhood that would have been great for me to go visit when I was younger.
There were, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's unfortunate. I mean, that still happens, of course, but I'm glad that you made a film about it. And but over time, right? So it started in the 1940s. That was the time frame you went back to. And how far up did it go to? Was it the 90s?
It went pretty close to the present when the film came out. I think the film came out, I should have looked this up.
That's all right.
2015? Is that?
I think around 2015.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it went up pretty close to 2013, I think. But I mean, we jumped a lot. I mean, it's only an hour. So we do certain things in each decade that we look at.
And then you went to work on Lesbians in Boys Town? Or so was there something in between some others?
Yeah, there was a bunch in between. I did a short film called Chained, which that one was the quickest I've ever done. It was a year from the concept to being at Frameline, the San Francisco LGBTQ Film Festival. So it was exactly a year. And that one looked at basically lesbians and queer women and how they love their wallet chains. Love their wallet chains. So it was a really fun movie to make. Yeah, that was really light and fun and did incredibly well on the festival circuit. People just loved that film. And then I did Vision 2030, The Future of SoCal. I worked with Spectrum News One to direct and produce that project, which really looked at housing and jobs and all of the different issues impacting Southern California. And then they did an update to that one as well that happened around COVID. And then I work with my wife on a couple of films. So she's a photojournalist and a photographer, but she's also a filmmaker. So I worked with her on her films, and she does more fiction, like narrative shorts. So that was really fun to work on. Yeah. Oh, and then my very first film was called Roof. And it's basically a Western showdown between an older woman and a younger woman on a roof in Miami.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that was a fictional film, and it premiered at New Directors New Films in New York City, and I actually got reviewed by Janet Maslin in the New York Times. So, and that
No.
was my thesis film that I did for my MFA.
Where did the idea come from for its roof?
Yeah, roof. Yeah,
Yeah.
it's all takes place on a roof.
Where did the idea for that come from?
I had been playing Frisbee in the backyard of a house in grad school, and now I'm not sure it was me because I don't think I'm that good at Frisbee, but it was somebody threw the Frisbee on the roof. And I thought, wouldn't it be neat if these two women, this one wanderer, she goes up, she sees a ladder, she's walking through a neighborhood and she climbs the ladder and she's hanging on a roof. And then this older woman comes home, pulls up into the driveway and grabs a beer and starts climbing the ladder to go up and have her beer and read her book on the roof. And now we have a showdown between the
Immediately, what pops into my head is that song Up on a Roof, you
two
know?
of them.
And then I flash immediately to that scene in Shawshank Redemption where they're sitting on the roof and they're drinking beers after they just did some hard labor. I don't know if you've seen that movie, Shawshank Redemption. How interesting. I love how ideas just come to people. And it's one thing, like, I have ideas all the time, but you know what? I haven't made a film about them, right? To be able to take it to that next step and be like, maybe I should tell this story that's in my head to other people. It's like taking that imagination and making it into a reality. I mean, what a beautiful thing to be able to do.
Yeah, it was really fun. I have not made narrative films really myself since then. I helped Chris with producing her films, but I haven't directed a narrative film since then, and it's something that I might want to try again in the future because I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Maybe you could, even though you work with each other, have you put out something that's a collaboration where it's
Well, Lesbians in Boys Town was
okay, let's talk about Lesbians in Boys Town. Where'd that idea come from?
It came from Chris. So she had moved from Canada to West Hollywood with me. And so she was new to the community. And one of the things we noticed is that the story around queer women just wasn't being told. We were so far in the minority in West Hollywood that it just wasn't something that was public knowledge. And so she thought that there would be a really interesting history there. And because I do history, I thought this would be interesting to explore. And so, yeah, I started working on it and I started doing research and talking to everyone I could to try and get what were the different areas. I mean, it took 3 years because we started it right before, literally a couple months before COVID. Yeah. And then because we were interviewing so many older people, we had to stop for like a year and a half or so and then start up again.
Now, of course, growing up in LA, I'm very familiar with West Hollywood, and I would think like, oh yeah, the lesbians, they live in Silver Lake or in Long
Long
Beach.
Beach.
Why would they live in Boys Town? And when I was growing up, West Hollywood was not even its own municipality. It wasn't its own city. It
Right.
was part of the county of Los Angeles, an incorporated area. And I remember, I'm trying to think, I believe I was 20 years old. It was before I went into the military, and I stood at a table. I believe it was outside of the public library with petitions. And we were having people sign the petitions to make West Hollywood its own city. So
Exactly.
1986, that would have been, I believe, 85, 86, because I went into the military in late 1986. It was before that. So it's hard for me to remember exact time periods at this point, but I didn't really think much about it. And then all of a sudden it became its own city, and they had their own police department and their own fire department, and how exciting that was. But yeah, it was so clear. I mean, there was the Palms, that was like the one lesbian bar in West Hollywood. Everything else was basically exclusively gay. And if it was open wider than just gay men, it was hard to get a drink. I couldn't get a drink at Peanuts for the life of me because the boy bartenders were paying attention to the boy customers. Yeah. So it definitely was and probably still is Boys Town. Were people upset about that, or was it just what it is, and people found a way to live there and work there and do whatever else.
We will be taking our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg, and our guest this hour is Betsy Kalin, an award-winning filmmaker, founder of Itchy Bee Productions, creator of Lesbians in Boys Town, winner of Best Documentary and Audience Award at Hollywood Queer Short Film Festival. We are always grateful to our sponsor and therefore happy to play their commercial. Stay tuned. Don't go away. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg, and our guest this hour is Betsy Kalin. Let's get back to the show.
They wanted to correct the record and have history show that queer women were there always and were an important part of the community. And then the festival that I just won at is predominantly gay men. So it used to be the California Men's Gathering Festival. And so the audience was 95% gay men, and they really appreciated and loved the film. So
yeah, well, we don't want to give too much of it away because we want people to go watch it. But maybe you can give us an example or two of the history that you cover that people wouldn't already know about.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, you touched on it. I do show the founding of the city, and they actually elected the first lesbian mayor anywhere in the U.S. when they were founded. So it was Valerie Torino. And then I look at what happened during the AIDS crisis, because that's really when the city was founded, was right in the middle of the AIDS crisis. And so a lot of the lesbians and queer women were really stepping up for gay men who were sick or who needed help. And that story isn't one that's told very often. And so we look at that in the film, as well as, you know, some of the people who are really doing a lot of good work and founding organizations. And then We talk about the bars that you mentioned. It really was a national scene in LA. It got national coverage and people really talked about Girl Bar. And I mean, it was a big thing. And so like the celebration of that. And then we start talking about what's happened, which is really that bars and bookstores and everything for queer women has faded. Really in the last decade and a half or so. So one of the reasons that I wanted to talk about this is to build it back up. That's how we get support, is building community with one another and having these spaces that we can go to. So
what do you think broke it down?
I think it was a combination of several things. One was cost. Right. I think gentrification was becoming worse. And so rents started raising. In fact, that's still the issue, you know. I think also that we didn't necessarily need queer spaces because we were getting assimilated into other spaces. And I think some people felt like, I'd rather just go to this hot new place that's a straight place and go there rather than supporting our spaces. So I think that could have been part of it too. And then, you know, I think also something that happens with queer women is if they couple up, they're not going out. So that was also an issue. So it was like, it was a bunch of factors, but it really was all around the country. And then bookstores, I mean, that's a whole different thing. That's Amazon and people going online. But I feel like there's, when I show the film and talk about it, especially with younger people, they really want these spaces. They want to be able to go to a queer night somewhere, and they want to be able to go to a bookstore that has queer books, and they want these experiences. And so I think it's important for us to build them for each other.
I don't want to detach from where you're going with this. I put in the chat the name of Boys Town Today in Chicago, in case you do go back. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you would have found it anyway. I didn't even realize it was called North Halsted. And I go out there from time to time.
Thank you. Yeah, me too. I mean, I love it. I love Chicago. It's a really great place. My dream was to make this film, you know, like a feature film, and to have three different cities. And so look at the difference between three different cities. So to do like West Hollywood, Chicago, and then one other place. And to see what queer women did in each of those spaces that was similar and what was different, and then what it's like today.
I think a suggestion for a third would be Provincetown, P-Town, because that's also considered more of a gay guy's space.
Yeah, until Women's Week. We have a week.
Yeah. Have fun, ladies. Yeah. That's so funny. You know, I still have the ticket stubs for my very first Pride festival that I ever attended in 1984. It was called Christopher Street West.
Yeah.
And it was in West Hollywood. We still have the ticket stubs. It was such a fun. I sat on top of a newspaper box. I think it was for about 5 hours watching that parade go by. It just went on and on and on and on. I had never seen anything like it. I was 18 years old. I was actually squatting in a house in West Hollywood at the time, and went out and saw everybody go by. I was like, wait a minute, police officers, moms, cheerleaders? I was like, I went into the festival seeing people hold hands, and I was like, cowboys? Cholos? I was like, what? I had never been anywhere like that in gay community. I'd been to Peanuts when I was underage with a fake ID. But I had never been to something like Pride Parade or Pride Festival. And just to see the range, the diversity in our community was, I was amazed by it all, really.
That's a great story. I think your ticket stub might be an important archival item.
Maybe. Yeah. Who do I get in touch with? The One Archive? Or
the One, exactly.
Oh, my goodness. So I'm wondering if this came up in your film at all, because you've used the term lesbian and you've used the terms queer women. I don't see that as the same thing. I see it as two distinct categories. I'm wondering if you do as well, and if this came up either directly or indirectly in the film.
No, I mean, I think people just, they use, it's usually lesbians and queer women, but
yeah, but what would be the difference? How would you describe the difference
I think
between
it's
those
because
two?
Because some people don't identify as lesbian. right? They identify as queer women. And so they might be some people who are non-binary, but they still want to identify as women, queer women. They might be somewhere in the spectrum along there. It's just, it's a generational thing as well. So to have young people saying that they're lesbians is pretty rare. It's not as common. So
that's sad. I wonder if that is also part of the reason why there's not more lesbian community.
Or visibility.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. I've even heard from people who have said, well, it's called Lesbians in Boys Town. I don't fit in that. And I'm like, I am not making the title Lesbians, Queer Women, Non-Binary People in Boys Town. I would love to do that, but nobody is going to ever show a film with a title that long.
Lesbians, etc. Or asterisk. That's the thing now. You just put a little asterisk. Oh, that is interesting, though, because I remember just the shift politically might be a contributing factor, too. Not just that people want to go to the new thing that's more of the straight scene, but it also, there were a couple of things that happened at the same time, right? One was the corporatization of our spaces, right? The prides weren't just San Diego Pride or LA. It was some company name, like we were Magic Mountain or something, and with the new roller coaster name, some corporate sponsorship. But then also, as the laws started to change, and it was like, yes, you can get married. Yes, you can serve in the military. Yes, you can adopt children. It was, oh, okay, now we can just go into the wider world. Because before that, we were hunkering down with each other in those lesbian bars because that was where we found community, or the living rooms with our potlucks. But we knew we didn't earn as much, so we didn't spend as much, and we didn't tip as much. And so that was going to impact the business part of the bar scene. But I wonder if it's also just that we don't have to hide anymore, or we don't have to sequester anymore. We can go, let's let them see us now.
Yeah,
right?
I think that definitely was part of it. I mean, it was a bunch of different complicated factors, but I mean, other people have looked at it and more related to the lesbian bars and what happened. I think in my film, I look at not just the bars, but like the cafes and the bookstores and the different organizations. So it really was all of these different things that we lost at the same time.
I don't know about West Hollywood, but I know when I was in San Diego in the 1980s, there was the gay bookstore Obelisk, which would probably just be LGBT in our common vernacular, but there was still a woman's bookstore in University Heights or Normal Heights on Adams Avenue, run by a lesbian, almost exclusively lesbian and feminist books. Was there something like that in West Hollywood? I'm just not remembering if there was a women's bookstore.
There wasn't a women's bookstore. We had a different light. So a different
yes,
light
yeah,
bookstore.
I remember that.
And then we had Sisterhood in Westwood. So Sisterhood was in Westwood.
Okay. I mean, that makes sense. It was Obelisk
it
was in
a
Hillcrest, which is the boys' area of, you know.
Right.
Yeah. So even in a little sleepy place like San Diego, the lesbians were mostly in Normal Heights and North Park, and the boys were in Hillcrest and Mission Hills. Like there really still was that separation. Yeah.
And it's always a separation based on economics.
I mean, class. Yeah.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. So what are you working on now? What's your next film?
So now I'm trying to get the film out there into the world. And so I've had two screenings in California at different universities and colleges, which has been great. And then I've had some here in Florida. And then I'm scheduling ones all over. So I'm trying to get it out. I mean, it's really good because it's multidisciplinary. So it's good for history. It's good for women and gender studies, sociology, all of these different things. So I'm trying to do that. And then also festivals, right? So I want it to screen festivals. So I'm applying for festivals. So even though the film is done, it's never completed, right? It continues in the distribution end, and it continues in the impact strategy. I am starting to work on a discussion and study guide so that when it does screen in public libraries or in classrooms, that people can have a free downloadable study guide and can have questions to talk about. Kind of like
very cool.
Doing. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. It's like the filmmaker and the professor in you, right? You're like, let's have a study guide with the film. I love that. I love that. Betsy, because you interviewed me for a oral history project through an organization called Outwards, and I was interviewed because I became one of their recorded stories for their trans specific. They were wanting to interview people who were trans, and so that's how we met. And it was just so funny because at the time I was in Orlando, and well, obviously you were in Florida as well, and I'm trying to remember, I didn't remember what neighborhood you were in, but it was funny that we got paired up and then we were both living in the same place.
Yeah, I don't think they did that on purpose at all. So I'm the senior interviewer for Outwards, and they just will send different people to me. And I read about you, and it said that you had grown up in California and where you had grown up and everything. And I'm like, oh, this is really interesting. And then as we're talking, I'm like, wait, you're in Orlando? I'm in Orlando. This is crazy. We have got to get together.
And of course, we eventually did. We went on a handful of double dates with our spouses, which was a lot of fun. How did you get involved with Outwards?
Wow. I was there pretty close to the beginning. So I think they were looking for someone to travel and to direct oral histories that we were going to film in the Midwest in winter time. And I saw the listing and I thought, okay, these are everything that I love. Queer people and oral history and documentary type interviews. And this is fabulous. Like, I totally want to be a part of this. And so I talked to Mason, who started Outwards, and just started working with them from there and never stopped.
That's awesome.
I really love their mission and I love what they're doing.
You might not know exactly, so it's okay, but about how many oral histories are currently available for people to listen to? It's a lot, right?
Hundreds, I think. I mean, I think I've already done a significant amount. And they have a whole collection of people who do the interviews. So, and what's so great about it is that they're all transcribed. And so you can search certain terms, and then all of these different interviews and oral histories show up. It's a really wonderful resource.
I went on there recently and I did a search on my name just as a shortcut to find my story. And then another video popped up. I was like, how come what? And it was Jude Patton because he had mentioned me in his interview. I was like, isn't that sweet? He's just such a wonderful guy, Jude Patton. But I was like, well, how nice. You know, I got mentioned. I love oral history projects. I remember it was probably in 1987 or 1988. I went into a tent at the San Diego Gay and Lesbian Pride. You know, it's just what it was called back then. And it was Lavender Archives, I think they're called. And they started up and they were recording oral histories. And so I went into the tent and I sat down and I did something then. And then probably around 2011 or 12, I was invited to do another one with that same organization. And I said, you know, I did one for you guys back 1987 or 88. And they were like, you did? I was like, Let me just put them together or something. Cause I was, you know, a younger lesbian at the time, you know, and then a trans man the second time around. They've been around quite a while. So I love these oral history projects that are available, the local ones and then Outwards, which is much larger, right, on the national scale. If you don't know about a person or an event, definitely look into oral history projects and check them out because it's a really wonderful way to get to know people and to learn about our history that's not in the books and that happened before the internet. And it's the same with your films, right? You capture stories that otherwise people would never hear about, they'd never learn about.
And especially now when we're losing so much of our history. So I think it's just so crucial to have these resources and just to be able to preserve it. But not only that, I mean, again, I work with younger people and they do not know and they feel so alone. And if they knew what our stories were, then I think that would be not only beneficial for them as people, but also then they can take action and try to make change. So, yeah.
You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On. and Xander Cag. And our guest this hour is Betsy Kalin, who is an award-winning filmmaker, founder of Itchy Bee Productions, creator of Lesbians in Boys Town, winner of Best Documentary and Audience Award at Hollywood Queer Short Film Festival. Stay tuned. We'll be back shortly after we play our sponsor's commercial.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Cag. Our guest this hour is Betsy Kalin, who is an award-winning filmmaker, founder of Itchy Bee Productions, creator of Lesbians in Boys Town, winner of Best Documentary and Audience Award at Hollywood Queer Short Film Festival. Let's get back to the show.
It's a little baffling to me sometimes how I was able to find all kinds of history, and I became very curious and interested about our history as a movement. And now there's the internet, and you can look up anything at any time of the day, and there are people who don't know the history. I just find it really interesting. We had no internet. I'm talking the early 80s, and I was able to find out about our history because I picked up a copy of Lesbian News, or I saw something on PBS, or there was gay and lesbian characters on soap operas. And it's interesting to me to hear people say things like, I don't see representation, or I can't find things. I'm like, it's everywhere. Maybe that's what it is. It's too everywhere. It doesn't stick out like maybe it used to. I don't know.
I think it's too much. It's just, you're overwhelmed. There's too much now. And we really had to, if we were interested in something, we really had to search it out, right? We had to go to the library and stuff was printed. I just think it was easier in some ways because we just didn't have this glut that you have to sift through. And now you have to teach them more about what is a good source and what isn't a good source and how to do that kind of digital literacy is more important.
I hate to break it up, but I have to go. I have a student who I'm now going to meet.
It was a pleasure meeting you.
It was really wonderful to meet you as well. You take care.
Okay, bye.
Unfortunately, I didn't leave the recording running, so you missed probably about 5 minutes of conversation between Xander and Betsy Kalin, as that recording didn't continue. We hope that you enjoy this hour with Betsy Kalin. Until next time, thank you for listening to The Umbrella Hour.